Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Team All of It, we have some exciting announcements about our upcoming Get Lit with All of It book club event. If you haven't heard already, we're spending the month reading the number one New York Times bestseller, The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett. It's a story of two light-skinned black twin girls growing up in a color-struck southern town. One of the twins decides to leave her community behind and pass for white for the rest of her life. The novel follows the reverberations of that decision over the course of decades. If you haven't already gotten your free e-copy, courtesy of our partners at the New York Public Library, it's not too late. Go to wnyc.org/getlit to find out how. And we here at All of It like to put our Get Lit books in context. So during our virtual event with Britt Bennett on October 1st, we'll also be speaking with historian and Stanford professor Allison Hobbs. Allison is the author of the book, A Chosen Exile, A History of Racial Passing in American Life. And we are excited to announce our musical guest, Allo Black. We'll hear special performances from his new album, All Love Everything, to cap off the evening. That's all happening on Thursday, October 1st at 7 p.m. Mark your calendars and follow us on Instagram at All of It WNYC, where you can follow online discussions ahead of the event. Until then, happy reading. Brains are fascinating. Sometimes they're sluggish and sometimes they're firing on all cylinders, making connections and split-second decisions. But sometimes brains can be really tricky. They can make you see things that aren't there. They can prevent you from remembering faces or names. The late Dr. Oliver Sacks knew that well. The face-blind neurologist earned a name for himself as a science communicator, writing in books like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Hallucinations, Musicophilia, and more about the strange relationship between our brains, our senses, and reality. But what about his brain, his big, big brain? How did it work? And how did he use it up until the end of his life? We learn a lot about this and about Oliver Sacks, the human being, from the filmmaker Rick Burns' recent documentary, Oliver Sacks, His Own Life, a life that informed his work, be it a parental expectation that he be a doctor or his own struggle with his sexual orientation. Let's listen to a bit of the trailer. The first voice you hear here is Oliver Sacks.
I first saw my analyst of 66. We are now in our 50th year, and we're beginning to get somewhere.
Please welcome Dr. Oliver Sacks.
He was the first major intellectual who spoke about diseases to the general public in a way that they could understand.
His writing brought back a central aspect of medicine, treat the person and not the disease.
Life threw so many things at him, some of which he brought on himself. He was the first to admit.
Rick Burns joins us now. Rick, thanks for being with us on All of It.
Thank you so much, Allison. It's wonderful to be with you.
This title could be taken several ways. How did you arrive at Oliver Sacks' His Own Life?
In a sense, you always want to put a note up on your computer saying, this is what this film is about, stupid,
right.
So that you don't get too into the high grass. And so in one sense, it's kind of really a sort of deadly straightforward thing. This is about Oliver Sacks, his life. But it's also his own life, and that sort of echoes something that he wrote in the New York Times shortly after we started filming him, where he disclosed the fact that he had a mortal illness. Mm-hmm. And that piece was called My Own Life. And he was consciously echoing the Scottish philosopher David Hume, who was a huge hero of Oliver Sacks, who when Hume had gotten a death sentence in the 18th century, had written an autobiography, an essay in the third person, interestingly, called My Own Life. And I think Oliver very much wanted to go on record and to set the record straight. No, to actually sum up. And we wanted to follow him in that effort, not to be sort of just kind of slavishly faithful to what he wanted us to say on the contrary, but to honor his own goal, which was to tell his story. He's a man who told the stories of countless people in the course of his life, and in some sense had hidden behind those stories. And now his story, he wanted his story to finish up that extraordinary anthology, so to speak. And, we wanted to do everything we could to have it echo that.
Yes, you mentioned, you know, you started production on this film shortly before he died of cancer. He only lived 8 months after his diagnosis. Had you ever been in the situation before as a filmmaker, filming someone in what he, she, or they knew were their last days?
Absolutely not. I mean, I'd read Oliver Sacks' work but didn't know him personally in any way. When we got a call in early 2015 from Kate Edgar, who's his editor and remarkable person, mm-hmm. who'd basically been Oliver's chief of staff for 30 years. And she'd gotten my number from a mutual friend, and she said, "Oliver's going to die. Will you come in and start filming him?" So we went, whoa. And wow. I didn't know he was gay. Nobody knew he was gay at that point, except for a handful of people. He was a closeted gay man who was born in 1933, who carefully guarded that, as he did many aspects of his own experience, the difficult stuff, the harrowing stuff, his family background in all sorts of ways, his schizophrenic brother Michael, his complicated relationship with his mother and with many authority figures. So we piled in, and, you know, we didn't have a chance to raise money. Or time. He would have been dead if we'd gone into an R&D phase. Mm-hmm. And so we had to take this man where we found him, which is to say an 81-year-old man who had arrived at the point where he'd just finished writing but not yet published a remarkably revealing book about himself on the move, in which he did discuss the fact that he was gay, the fact that his mother had said as a result of that, "You are an abomination to me. I wish you had never been born," that he had fled England, that he had been a drug addict on amphetamines, that he had been woefully unhappy, you know, throughout much of his life and struggled to find and escape himself for a very long time. So that image of Oliver, that we might take away from the surface of his prose, of a kind of a calm, avuncular, wise, insightful, empathetic, brilliant writer, doctor, that's basically true. But underneath it all is a person of enormous complexity and extremes who is actually much more like many of the people that he wrote about than not. And that really sort of, you know, that began to be clear very, very quickly. So that's, you know, that's where Alice and we started from in this project. And it was really, you know, a remarkably revelatory process that my colleagues and I were taken through, and that's different. Usually, you know a lot about what you want to make a film about. Mm-hmm. You raise money, and then you go try and make it, and it changes. This kind of, I dare say, changed us more than we changed it in the process of making the film.
My guest is Rick Burns. We're talking about his film, Oliver Sacks, His Own Life. So this person we see and we meet, Oliver Sacks, in the documentary, because we really do get to meet him. I mean, everybody knows him, but we get to meet him. He was always writing, and it was either patient always. Observations or poetic musings on his life. He kept a journal up until his final moments. What did you learn from his writings that helped you shape this film?
you know, he was he was called Inky as a little boy yeah. by his family, and that was really true. His fingers were literally ink stained all the time, and you know, he liked to say that he wrote the way he spoke, and I think that that's very, very true. That, you know, sort of the language kind of came out of him and sort of like streamed down his arm and through his pen. He always had two pens in case one ran out of ink. He was fetishistically fond of his writing instruments. And he basically, I think writing was not only a vocation for him, but it was a means of survival. I think that it's the way he communicated, the way he existed in the world, and without which I think he would have perished, you know, long before, you know, 2015. He, you know, had an extraordinary need to both be in touch and to retain a certain kind of invisibility. I think he felt invisible to himself in many ways. And I think that writing is one of those ways of being that allows you to be both at once, because you're both there and not there. And he said in the piece I mentioned before in the Times, My Own Life, announcing that he had a fatal illness, you know, he said very clearly, you know, spoke very clearly about that sort of that relationship with what he called the special intercourse of writers and readers, You know, and he chose those words very carefully. Mm. You know, intercourse was something that was tough for him in all mm-hmm. sorts of ways, including literally. And I think that, you know, by being able to be there without being present was a way that kind of allowed him to project and express himself as powerfully as possible. And I think that that's something we found out about him through being with him. You know, his late in life partner, Billy Hayes, the only person he ever had a successful relationship with sexually and romantically, went through Oliver's library of 10,000 books after Oliver died on August 30th, 2015, just about 5 years ago. And one day called us up and just in tears, in astonishment. And Billy said, you know, I have to tell you, almost every volume has been carefully noted in the margins, a form of writing which no writer would ever think anybody else would see, a kind of an ongoing, lifelong conversation with writers going back to Homer and Plato and coming down to somebody, you know, whose book he had just received written yesterday. And so this person who lived in that world, you know, no, he might say, exclamation point, or, you know, just kind of constant dialogue. And I found that itself extremely moving, and we filmed some of that. And then in a way, the last moment of our film, not the last moment, but towards the end of our film, he was writing up to virtually the day he died. 2 days before, he was still writing in his notebook, and Billy showed us that notebook, in which literally the pen in a spidery way finally loses control, and he can't write anymore. And Billy said, Oliver said, I can't do it anymore, Billy. And that was that. And so to be able to be with someone, so to speak, right down to the moment where this kind of lifeline, which what his writing was, finally reaches the very end. And he died 36 hours later with Billy on one side of him, Kate Edgar on the other in bed. I mean, how remarkable.
My guest is Rick Burns. The name of the film is Oliver Sacks, His Own Life. As you mentioned, we learned so much about, we learned about his family, about his brother having an issue, about his mother's extreme homophobia, about his struggling with his own sexual orientation, about going to San Francisco and living this wild life. And there's so much in the film. What was something that was difficult for him to talk to you about, or difficult for you to get him to be candid about?
You know, I think that he had arrived at that point. I mean, think about it. He was in his 80s. He had come to his own decision now to talk about things he had never talked about outside of a very small circle of friends and family. He had written a book, but not yet published it, on the move when he got this diagnosis. And so he's a person who's already nearing the end and summing up. And then he gets something which focuses the mind possibly more than anything else does, which is a death sentence. Hmm. And at that point, I think Oliver finished making a decision which he'd been in the process of making for a number of years, which was that he wanted to sum up. He wanted to, not in a kind of a confessional, helpless way, but in a very clear way, to make the decision that he was going to cross a set of lines that he had always stayed on one side of. And so, you know, while he was very, very shy, but also shockingly open, no one, Allison, will ever think of Jell-O in quite the same way after they see this film. He was fastidious and sort of, you know, all over the place, you know, well-dressed with, you know, kind of like funny socks and an untucked shirt, you know, all these kind of strange things which were sort of coexisted in him, mm-hmm. Extreme in all sorts of ways. And he just was that way. And I think that that's one of the reasons why he felt he had to protect himself. Like many people with no armor, you know, you kind of try to create a version of armor, in his case, in words and reticence. And so I'm not sure there was much he wasn't willing to talk about.
That's
when we got there. I think he was really ready to give the whole thing, which, by the way, is like incredibly moving and was extraordinarily gave us all my colleagues and me an extraordinary sense of responsibility. You know, he didn't say, okay, and by the way, my estate will retain editorial control of this film, and here's mm-hmm. a non-disclosure agreement and stuff like that, which, you know, would not have been at all uncommon, and I wouldn't have taken the job, but, you know, somebody would have, of course.
Sure.
But he basically said, you know what?
Make the
film. I get you.
Yeah.
Make the film, and I'll never see it. He never saw a frame of it. And so what an amazing thing to be able to, like, have been... had that degree yes. of trust and responsibility invested in you.
Let me dive in here and tell people where they can see it. It's on the cinema platform Kino Marquee and Film Forum Virtual Cinema. Rick Burns, thanks for joining us.
Allison, thank you so much.